When you stand on the sidewalk, right, and you look up at a towering skyscraper, or you drive across a massive steel suspension bridge, you probably think of that steel as, well, just steel.
Right, yeah,
Just
it's a solid chunk of metal.
exactly, like a solid, static, completely unchanging block of metal. It's,
Yeah.
you know, the ultimate symbol of permanence. But the reality is that inside that metal, at a level that's way too small for the human eye to see, is a highly dynamic, chaotic battleground.
Oh, absolutely.
It is literally a microscopic war zone of crystal structures just fighting for dominance.
We certainly perceive it as this quiet, inert material, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the atomic reality of steel, especially when it's subjected to changes in temperature or stress, it's incredibly violent.
Yeah.
It's complex. The atoms are constantly like negotiating their positions based on the environment they find themselves in.
And that hidden world is exactly our mission for today's deep dive. We are unpacking a fascinating, highly technical 1990 research paper from Cambridge University researchers S.A. Khan and H.K.D.H. Padesha. The paper is called Kinetics of Martensitic Transformation in Partially Bainitic 300 Meber Steel.
Yeah, and the title might sound like a massive mouthful, I know,
Yeah.
but the concepts inside it are entirely foundational to the modern world you interact with every single day.
For sure.
The specific material they were looking at, 300 Meb steel, it's a high silicon, medium carbon alloy. And it is the exact same stuff used in the landing gear of heavy commercial aircraft.
Wow, okay.
So when a massive airplane hits the tarmac, I mean, the materials absorbing that impact without just shattering, they rely entirely on the microscopic architecture described in this exact paper.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Okay.
Because you really should care about what these researchers discovered, we are going to decode how engineers actually manipulate this this chaotic internal structure of steel to create materials that are incredibly strong, but also, you know, highly flexible.
Right. It's all about controlling the chaos.
Exactly. So to really grasp the magnitude of what Khan and Padesha achieved, we first have to understand how a solid block of metal can even change its internal structure in the first place.
Yeah, I think we definitely need to establish a ground rule for that.
Right.
Because to the naked eye, a steel beam is just a steel beam.
Right. It's hard to imagine the internal structure shifting around unless you like melt it down to liquid.
Exactly. But think of
Yeah.
the atoms inside the solid steel like members of a marching band.
Okay, a marching band. I like that.
The band is moving across a field, and they are in a very specific, neat, square formation. Everyone is marching in lockstep. In metallurgy, we call this specific formation a phase.
Yeah.
So when the steel is extremely hot, its marching band is in a phase called austenite.
So the atoms are arranged in this specific geometric pattern, but then the temperature drops.
Right, the environment changes. And just like a marching band transitioning from a square formation into, say, a diamond formation while continuing to march, the atoms in the solid steel physically rearrange themselves.
Without melting.
Exactly, without ever becoming a liquid. They snap into a new geometric lattice. They just snap into new positions.
And the specific mystery these researchers wanted to solve was what happens when you intentionally create a mixed microstructure during that snapping process?
Right.
Meaning, you know, you don't let the whole marching band form just one shape, you force them into two different shapes at the exact same time.
Yeah, they wanted to know what happens if you take that hot austenite and cool it just enough to partially transform it into a phase called bainite.
Okay.
And then before it finishes, plunging the temperature all the way down to form an ultra-hard, incredibly brittle phase known as martensite.
Which, historically speaking, was considered a terrible idea by engineers.
I had completely botched heat treatment, yeah.
Right, because if the prevailing wisdom was that mixed structures ruins the integrity of the steel, then Khan and Padesha must have faced incredible skepticism. The old belief was that putting bainite inside an otherwise pure martensitic structure would lead to like a serious deterioration in the metal's ductility, its toughness, its strength.
Yeah, early research firmly suggested you wanted your steel's internal structure to be uniform. A pure structure was a predictable structure.
Makes sense.
But newer research at the time, specifically studies by Tomita and Okabayashi, which the paper cites as a catalyst, flipped that entire assumption on its head.
Really?
Yeah, those earlier studies found that a mixed microstructure doesn't ruin the steel. It actually enhances both its strength and its toughness at the same time.
Wait, I love this. It's like packing a suitcase.
Okay, how so?
Well, you'd think throwing in a bunch of bulky boxes like the bainite would ruin your ability to pack the rest of your clothes tightly, which would be the martensite.
Right.
But instead, those boxes act like perfect little compartments, making everything else fit even better.
That is a great way to look at it. The analogy works perfectly because at the microscopic level, as the lower bainite forms, it physically subdivides the regions of the parent metal.
It carves it up.
Exactly. It effectively refines the grain size. So when the rest of the metal continues to cool and finally transforms into that hard martensite, it has to form in smaller, tighter little packets.
Because of that subdivision.
Right, because the bainite walls have already boxed it in. And in metallurgy, this grain size effect leads to massive strengthening. Plus, the bainite itself is strengthened by the constraint of being completely surrounded by the harder martensite.
Oh, wow. They mutually reinforce each other.
Precisely.
That completely changes the paradigm. So if mixed microstructures are actually, like, a superpower for steel, how did they actually prove this was happening in the lab?
Well, the laboratory setup they engineered in 1990 is incredibly meticulous for this exact reason. Kahn and Padeshi needed to understand the precise kinetics, the speed, and the triggers of this reaction.
Right, because we are talking about physical transformations happening in fractions of a second inside solid metal.
Exactly. So to do that, they compared two entirely different states of the 300M steel. First, they took the commercial steel, the as-received factory stuff. This material is chemically heterogeneous, meaning the specific alloy mix of carbon, silica, and iron varies slightly from one microscopic point to the next.
Right, because commercial manufacturing is never perfect at the atomic scale. You get, like, microscopic clusters of carbon here, a little more silicon over there.
Yeah. So they wanted to compare that regular heterogeneous steel against a perfectly homogeneous sample, a piece of steel where the atoms are perfectly evenly distributed throughout the entire structure.
Wait, how do you even make a piece of solid steel perfectly uniform? You can't just throw it in a blender.
No, you apply extreme prolonged heat. You literally force the solid atoms to diffuse and distribute themselves evenly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they took tiny samples of the steel, just 3 millimeters in diameter and 2 centimeters long, and they sealed them inside quartz tubes filled with argon gas.
Okay, so the argon acts as, like, an inert shield. It prevents the incredibly hot steel from reacting with oxygen in the air and rusting.
Right. Once sealed in the quartz, they baked those samples at 1300 degrees Celsius for 3 solid days.
3 days.
Just to homogenize the chemical composition. And even after that intense baking process, they electroplated the specimens with a layer of nickel to lock in the surface integrity.
That level of preparation is just staggering. But, I mean, it still leaves the biggest question. How do you measure the marching band changing its formation?
You measure it indirectly.
Right, because you can't put a solid piece of metal under a microscope inside a furnace and watch the atoms move.
No, you use an instrument called a high-speed dilatometer.
Yeah, I was looking at the mechanism for this in the source material, and it is brilliant. A dilatometer measures volumetric changes, right?
You're right.
It basically tracks microscopic swelling in the length of the sample. Because when the parent austenite physically snaps into the harder martensite, the steel actually gets a tiny bit larger.
The atomic lattice expands, yes. Mm. And because they conducted these dilatometer experiments in a controlled environment hooked up to a microcomputer, they could record the temperature and the microscopic swelling at millisecond intervals.
Millisecond by millisecond. That's incredible. And the reason it swells is what really caught my attention. When the temperature drops rapidly, the carbon atoms essentially get stuck, right?
Exactly. They don't have time to migrate out of the iron crystal.
So they get trapped inside the lattice, and they physically force the crystal to bulge and stretch outward to accommodate them. The neat square formation gets stretched into a rectangle.
Yeah, that is the fundamental mechanism of the martensitic transformation. It's a displacive transformation. Every fraction of a percent of expansion told them exactly when and how fast the trapped carbon was forcing the martensite into existence.
So they track the swelling of the commercial heterogeneous steel, and they track the swelling of their perfectly baked uniform steel. What was the result? Did the chemical clumping in the commercial steel ruin the transformation?
The main difference between the regular steel and the perfectly baked steel was just the temperature range.
Oh, interesting.
Because the heterogeneous steel is essentially a composite of different microscopic alloys, its transformation gets stretched out over a wider range of temperatures.
Ah, so each tiny chemically distinct region has its own specific temperature where it wants to change.
Exactly. Whereas the perfectly homogenized steel transforms much more abruptly because every single atom is experiencing the exact same chemical conditions.
Okay, that seamlessly brings us to the specific chemical puzzle that dictates when these changes happen. Because there is a very specific threshold for this reaction, right?
Yes, we call that threshold the martensite start temperature, or EMS.
EMS. Got it.
If you are cooling a piece of hot austenite down, The EMS is the exact thermal point where the metal physically begins turning into that hard, swelling martensite.
Like water hitting 32 degrees Fahrenheit and starting to turn into ice. The starting line is highly predictable for pure austenite. But the whole point of this Cambridge experiment was to see what happens when you partially transform the steel into bainite first.
Right. And introducing that bainite fundamentally alters the environment for the remaining metal. It completely messes with the starting line.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because when bainite forms inside the steel, it doesn't just sit there acting like a passive stone wall. It actively changes the chemistry.
It does.
As the bainite forms, it rejects carbon. It essentially dumps all of its excess carbon into the leftover untransformed metal, the residual austenite.
Right. So the bainite is carving up the space.
Yeah.
But it's also forcing carbon out, heavily enriching the remaining austenite pockets.
But wait, let me push back on this because I found a real paradox here in the data.
Okay, let's hear it.
Earlier, we established that the bainite acts like a physical wall, subdividing the space and boxing the austenite in.
Yes.
If it is physically restricting the space, and we know a martensite needs to swell and expand to form, shouldn't that physical constraint make it harder for the martensite to even start forming?
That is the logical assumption, yes.
Yeah. Right, so why are you saying the carbon dump is the crucial factor? Doesn't the physical roadblock dictate the starting line? If I'm trying to blow up a balloon inside a small wooden box, the box is going to stop me.
You're hitting on the exact core paradox that Kahn and Padacia were trying to untangle.
Hmm.
It is incredibly counterintuitive.
Yeah.
You would assume the physical constraint of the bainite walls would suppress the transformation by denying the physical room to swell.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating here is that the researchers prove the physical presence of the bainite doesn't significantly influence the martensite start temperature at all.
Wait, really? It doesn't matter.
The physical constraint restricts the ultimate size of the martensite plates, but it doesn't stop them from triggering. The trigger is entirely dictated by the carbon.
Oh, wow. So the chemistry completely overrides the physics of the space.
Exactly. The carbon enrichment makes the remaining austenite more stable. It acts as a thermodynamic stabilizer. The more carbon you pump into that residual austenite, the more thermodynamically comfortable it becomes in its current marching band formation.
It wants to stay as austenite.
Right. It resists changing. So you have to undercool the steel to a much lower temperature to finally get the martensite to form.
It's like adding antifreeze to water. You have to get the environment way, way colder than the normal freezing point to finally overcome that chemical stability and force it to turn to ice.
The carbon dump from the bainite acts as an intense microscopic antifreeze.
That brilliantly explains the chemistry side of the puzzle. We know the carbon antifreeze delays the starting temperature. But we also need to look at the physics of how the martensite physically spreads through the steel once the temperature does get cold enough.
Right, because this wasn't a smooth process at all.
No, the researchers actually had to invent a brand new mathematical equation just to describe the chaos.
Yeah, for a long time prior to this paper, the progress of this transformation was modeled by an old empirical formula called the Koistinen and Marburger equation.
From like 1959, right?
Exactly. And it was a very reliable endpoint predictor. It worked fairly well for predicting the final volume of martensite once the metal had completely cooled to room temperature.
But when Kahn and Padacia used their microcomputer hook dilatometer to zoom in on the very early stages of the reaction.
Those first few milliseconds.
Right after the temperature drops below the starting line, they found that the old model completely fell apart. The lab data deviated sharply from the math.
Because the old math assumed the martensite would form at a steady, predictable rate based on how fast the temperature was dropping, it missed a critical variable.
And that variable is autocatalysis, right?
Yes, autocatalysis.
I mean, I know auto means self, and the catalyst speeds things up or triggers a reaction. So does the martensite somehow trigger its own creation?
It does. Think back to that violent swelling we discussed. When the first flat plates of martensite snap into existence inside the parent austenite, they stretch and warp the metal around them.
Right.
They create massive structural strain and microscopic defects in the surrounding atomic lattice.
They are essentially damaging the neighborhood as they move in.
Exactly. Arrays of dislocations are generated, and these newly created structural defects act as embryos, or seeds. They instantly stimulate and trigger the immediate growth of more martensite plates.
Oh man, this is literally a microscopic zombie outbreak.
A zombie outbreak.
Yeah. It's not just that people are turning into zombies at a steady, predictable rate based on the temperature. It's that every time a new zombie is created, it immediately bites three more people. And then those three violently bite nine more. The creation of one directly fuels the creation of the next. It's a chain reaction.
That is highly accurate, actually. The formation of one plate induces the embryos for the next plates. The old equation assumed a steady nucleation rate. It didn't account for the localized strain driving exponential growth.
The old math didn't account for the zombies biting each other, so the initial burst is way faster and infinitely more chaotic.
This brings us to the true breakthrough of their research. They successfully derived a new mathematical law, a kinetic equation that directly accounts for this autocatalysis.
And when they mapped their new equation over the deltometer data,
the experimental data aligned perfectly. And the beautiful part, this new law accurately predicts the kinetics of the transformation, regardless of whether there was bainite there beforehand or not.
Wait, really? So whether it's a mixed microstructure with bainite walls or a pure block of austenite, the exact same math applies.
Exactly. The initial defects generated by the earlier bainite transformation didn't corrupt the math for the martensite's chain reaction. It proved the fundamental nature of the transformation remains constant.
So what does this all mean? Let's zoom out and recap the journey we just took, because we covered a tremendous amount of ground.
We certainly did.
We started by learning that the old rules were fundamentally wrong. Intentionally mixing structural phases in steel doesn't ruin it. It actually makes it stronger through subdivision.
The grain size effect.
Right. Then we saw how measuring microscopic expansion with a deltometer tells us what's happening inside the metal millisecond by millisecond.
Tracking the trapped carbon.
Yes, and that led to the carbon dump paradox. It's not the physical roadblock of the bainite that delays the martensite, but the chemical rejection of carbon acting as antifreeze.
The chemistry dictates the starting line.
And finally, we learned that the spread of martensite is a chain reaction fueled by structural defects, an autocatalytic zombie outbreak.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this isn't just theory. Being able to predict these exact transformations allows engineers to custom tailor the heat treatment of commercial steels.
Right, so the landing gear of airplanes or the structural beams of buildings don't fail under stress?
Exactly. You need the extreme hardness of martensite, but also the toughness of the bainitic structure so it bends instead of completely shattering.
You literally have to control the chaos inside the metal. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the microscopic architecture of steel.
My pleasure.
I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over. In this paper, we saw how internal flaws, stress, and microscopic defects, things we usually view as bad, actually act as the necessary seeds for an autocatalytic chain reaction that makes the steel incredibly tough.
Strength born from imperfection.
Exactly. It makes you wonder, you know. As we move into the era of 3D printed metals and custom nanomaterials, could we intentionally engineer perfect flaws at the atomic level? Could we trigger highly controlled chain reactions that build smart materials completely unlike anything found in nature? Next time you look up at a steel bridge, just remember, the metal holding you up isn't a static block. It's a frozen chain reaction fueled by the very defects hidden inside it.